Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Unsettled by Patricia Rice, narrated by Megan Tusing. All the departed may return, but some are destined to haunt. Nicholas Abrams, The Shell and the Colonel. Part 1, The Family Portrait. Madison, Wisconsin. The real estate agent's message was curt. We have a showing at 1 this afternoon. The house needs to be completely cleared out by then. Van Reinhardt stuffed her briefcase with final exams, left a note on her office door saying she would be back after 1, and hurried to the staff parking garage. She tossed her briefcase into the passenger side of the Honda and wheeled out in the direction of her father's house. The high pulse of urgency made her buzz like too much caffeine. She headed toward the west side suburb of Oakcrest, where she had spent her childhood, a tree-lined neighborhood on the outskirts of Madison. The house had been built in the post-World War II boom, a three-bedroom ranch, solid, respectable, unremarkable. The neighborhood had once abutted farmland, but now was surrounded by designer communities boasting large lots, two- and three-story houses, curving driveways and names like Meadowlark Estates. Her father had refused to move. Martin Reinhardt had died a classic old man's death, the kind people warn you against. A freak April snowstorm sent him outside armed with a shovel. The heavy wet spring snow made shoveling difficult. A heart attack took him, quick, clean, and fatal. He had been 88. A month later, Van's internal seismograph still registered aftershocks. Her father's presence had dominated her life. His absence rearranged everything. A house changes after someone dies. The ranch house had always felt claustrophobic, deprived of air. Windows unopened even in the summer, curtains perpetually drawn. The first thing Van did upon unlocking the front door was to throw open the windows. After her mother died, her father had sealed off rooms, claiming it saved on winter heating bills. But Van thought he meant to extinguish the memory of those who once had lived with him. The shades in her mother's bedroom were pulled, as they had been when she was alive. The light had bothered her, mother had always complained, aggravated her condition. Immediately after her death, the army of orange bottles that had crowded her night table like pieces on a chessboard, medications meant to ameliorate or ward off symptoms of some undisclosed disorder, disappeared, leaving no sign of their former occupancy. Across the hall, the only vestige left in Van's bedroom was the skeletal frame of her childhood bed. Her father had contracted his living space into 3 rooms, his study, the kitchen, and the spare bedroom. For the past month, she had spent weekends in these spouseless quarters, gathering up old-fashioned tweed jackets, buttoned wool vests and trousers, skinny ties and leather Oxfords to take to Goodwill. She boxed up his books and papers and took them to the geology department to be archived. His old Selectric II typewriter and a box of ribbons she donated to the battered women's shelter. He had scorned computers and never owned one. Van was all business, made to-do lists, and willed herself not to get emotional. Parents die, she told herself. It happens. The three of them had moved into the newly constructed house in 1950, the year Van was born. The place had never been remodeled, nor had her parents purchased any new furniture. Her father never cared about such things. Her mother only cared about where to get her next prescription filled. The house was a 1950s museum. Pink and gray bathroom tile, red kitchen linoleum. Goodwill had taken the brown fabric couch and the cracked leather chair that bore the imprint of her father's body. The rarely used maple dining room set and the faded flower rugs went to a consignment store. From more than 1,000 books, she kept 1. An 1871 volume of Longfellow's poems, covered in forest green cloth, with a worn gilt design on the spine. The elegant signature of Elizabeth Conrad, her father's mother, her grandmother, graced the title page. Van had never met her. What could she tell from one book? That she was literate? That she appreciated poetry? She supposed her grandmother's hands had once held this relic, the only piece of literature in her father's overstuffed bookshelves. It contained Longfellow's first epic poem, Evangeline. She must have read the poem to her father. Why else would he have given her that name? You discover things when you clean out a house after a person dies unexpectedly. For instance, there was no sign of alcohol, not even a lone bottle of port or sherry, the preferred beverage of her father's aging colleagues. Martin had never mentioned anything to her about his abstinence, but it made sense. Van attributed his lack of criticism over the last few years to the mellowing, the wearing down of old grudges that was supposed to accompany old age, and was grateful that they had established a kind of demilitarized zone in their phone calls. Even her position in women's studies no longer piqued him, nor did he rebuke her about his lack of grandchildren. She wasn't sure when her father had stopped drinking, but she knew when he had started. 30 years ago, the night of her mother's funeral, the last night she had slept in her childhood bed. After the funeral, Van had stayed in the house with her father. She woke in the dark with the familiar sense of someone calling her. They had called it sleepwalking when she was a child, but she always knew she was not sleeping. Her forays were just long enough to take in the night air, look at the winking stars and the great white swath of Milky Way. Sometimes the moon was visible, but the best was when it wasn't, for then the stars became more numerous, sharp, and glittering in the night sky. After a while, she would go back to her bedroom, satisfied that she had made her appearance to whatever had summoned her. She distinctly recalled the feeling of cool dampness on the soles of her feet as she slid under the covers and re-entered sleep. The night of her mother's funeral, this childhood habit got her out of bed, and she padded barefoot through the darkened house, heading for the back door. She was stopped in her tracks by the shadow of a hunched figure sitting at the kitchen table. She could smell the whiskey before she made out the shape of the bottle planted firmly in front of him, his hand holding a water glass. "Dad, what are you doing up?"
"Go back to bed, Vanjie,"
he said in a thick voice.
"Leave your old man to grieve in his own way."
She had obeyed his command for the next 30 years. They were not so much estranged as they were restrained around each other, held back, as if approaching the molten core of loss and love would set off a mutual conflagration, that sudden eruption of scorching anger and searing disappointment. The last time it happened was after she won a prestigious scholarship for graduate school at the University of Chicago. She called her father to tell him about it, but also to say she had fallen in love and was going to take the summer off to canoe in the Boundary Waters. Then her mother was suddenly and inexplicably dead. Later, when she told her father she was deferring her scholarship for a semester, letting him believe it was due to her grief, he wrote her a scathing letter enumerating his failures as a husband and a father. He had computed his only daughter into the sum of his losses, one too many by his accounting. Martin retreated into himself and grew into a sorry, solitary, wounded old man. There were no other women in his life, as far as Van knew. A few long-time, long-suffering colleagues from the university invited him for the occasional dinner. There were lengthy correspondences with some of his past students. But nobody grew close enough to heal the invisible wounds. They had scarred over, and Van knew not to touch them. She pulled her Honda into the driveway where the dumpster loomed. The big oak in front of the house was leafed in mid-June green. Next to it, a for sale sign was staked in the ground. The two words felt bruising, as if she had been punched. She wondered if the house retained memories of the lives once lived inside its walls. Or, like a body emptied of breath, did it too suffer a death? She checked the time. She had less than an hour. The house was stripped bare, right down to the hardwood floors and painted walls. Only two items remained in the study, the place where her father had spent uncountable hours. She took one last look at the oversized oak roll-top desk and decided it had no future with her. She had no room for it, not in her studio apartment, nor in her heart. His four-drawer file cabinet was the last thing to be sorted. The top drawers yielded yellowed manila file folders with syllabi dating from 1950, old conference announcements, lecture notes, the debris of Professor Martin Reinhardt's long academic career. Nothing worth saving. This lot she consigned to the waiting trash bag. The bottom drawer stuck. Van knelt and pulled, nearly tipping the metal cabinet onto herself. It was locked. What the hell? She rummaged through the desk for the missing file keys. Nothing. She hurried to the car, opened her toolbox, grabbed the hammer, and went back into the study. With a couple of sharp hits, the mechanism gave. The drawer gaped open. She jumped back as if something alive lurked in the drawer, some creature with teeth. On top of several fresh manila files was a yellow sticky note. Talk to Vanjie. The little hairs on her arm rose. A hot fury made her heart pound. Talk to Vanjie, she said aloud. How dare you snag me now with a promise of an explanation? You're dead and properly buried next to Mother. Whatever talk you wanted is never going to happen. She glanced at the files neatly labeled in her father's precise handwriting. Family portrait, road map of Iowa, important addresses in Maple Grove. Her watch said 5 minutes to 1. Van shoved the map and folders into a large brown grocery bag. She left the house keys on the kitchen counter with a note for the agent, saying she would call the appraisers to come for the desk and file cabinet. Van had no regrets pulling the door shut. She was officially an orphan. Fine. She had felt like one for most of her life. Besides, didn't being an orphan have its benefits? No parental deities hovering? She eyed the dumpster and dropped the trash bag and the grocery bag with the map and files into it and got into her car. Done. Finito. Freedom. She backed the Honda out of the driveway. She had finished all the remaining tasks. The house was on the market. She had purposely made no plans for the summer. She needed open space for once. No extra summer teaching, no conferences. Only one overdue paper to submit. Then a much-needed sabbatical. But self-reproach and a primal grip of filial obligation slowed her down. She put her foot on the brake. Was it wrong to dispose of the files without at least looking over what he had assembled? After all, those were his last words addressed to her. She jammed the car into park. The rented dumpster was large and grotty from years of use. Van hoisted herself over the edge of it, reached down for the grocery bag, and lost her balance, landing in a pile of rubbish. The rusted-out toaster oven, a 1950s aluminum coffee percolator, chipped plates and stained coffee cups, gray mop heads, dish rags, the kitchen sink drainer, wire coat hangers, worn towels, bath mats, moldy pillows and comforters that had lost their puff. Her knee scraped the dumpster's edge and left her with a burn. She sat in the bottom of the filthy dumpster, catching her breath, and cried like a girl who had fallen off her bike, sad, whimpering cries. At last, embarrassed and furious, she grabbed the grocery bag, did a push-up against the edge, threw a leg over, and leveraged herself out of the dumpster, hoping to God no one saw her. She tossed the paper bag into the passenger seat on top of her briefcase and drove a half hour to Picnic Point, the finger of land that jutted into Lake Mendota. Underneath her jeans, the scraped knee stung. In the empty parking lot facing the lake, she glared at the bag of files. They felt radioactive. Talk to Vanjie. Anger and tears were a terrible combination. Nobody ever tells you rage can be a part of grief. Anyway, now it was too goddamned late to talk. Gripping the steering wheel, Van stared at the open water. The lake seduced her like a bad relationship with its changeable moods, its wild unpredictability. Smooth and sparkling with sunlight one minute, dark and choppy the next. Today, the water showed its beneficent face, sunlit, lapping the shore like a kitten. She wished for a violent storm to match her mood. Van reached into the bag and opened the top folder, revealing a large sepia portrait of the Reinhardt family. On the back, her father had penciled in the date, 1900, and the names of his grandparents, Adam, Elizabeth, Letty, and the names of their 8 children. Out of the whole assembly, she identified Jacob, the handsome young man who anchored the far right of the group. Martin had once pointed him out as his father, her own grandfather, whom she never met and knew nothing about. Jacob was obviously the oldest of the children and looked slightly out of place. Although carefully labeled, the other file folders were empty, except for a typed sheet with addresses for the Maple Grove, Iowa town office, the Ida Grove courthouse, and the location of the cemetery. A post-it note was stuck onto a folded map of Iowa. Ask Vanjie to do some research. Her father knew her reputation for being inquisitive. Nosy and meddlesome, he had called her, which made her a troublesome daughter, but a good researcher. Now he was taking advantage of her from beyond the grave. Van opened the map, where yellow highlighter marked a route from Madison to Maple Grove in western Iowa. Had he been planning a trip? He had never mentioned it. As far as she knew, once he left Iowa for the University of Wisconsin, he never returned. He was the youngest of a large family. He had never said much about the people in the portrait. A few scraps of words recalled here and there. German, immigrants, pioneer farmers. Hardly enough to make a whole sentence. She got out of the car and sat on a bench by the lakeshore and looked over to the forefinger of land. Picnic Point. She always figured she had been conceived there, months before her parents' marriage took place. The sparse family album held a black and white photo of her father and mother in a canoe on Picnic Point, the two of them shining and beautiful, her father with his dark almond eyes and sun-tanned skin that had earned him the football team's nickname of Indian. It was her father who had paddled the canoe. As a child, she thought the picture showed her parents in love. As an adult, she thought they were probably in post-coital bliss. Outside that one photograph, she never recalled that expression on either of them during her lifetime. Scowls and grimaces, theirs and hers, predominated. As far as she could remember, her parents always had separate bedrooms. To her knowledge, they had never owned a canoe. The lapping water was like a heartbeat, and the pungent tannin of late spring lake water was deeply familiar. Van let the lake pull her down and back. Since childhood, she had loved to time travel. Whenever her father had suspected her of daydreaming, he chastised her, as if it were some reprehensible defect in her character. She learned to hide her penchant, but never completely lost the habit. Living alone, Van talked out loud to her cat and often to herself, long disquisitions on life's few pleasures and innumerable vicissitudes. At the edge of the lake, she imagined the Ho-Chunk, the Winnebagoes, who had pitched their birch huts and teepees and made their living along the very shore where she was sitting. She knew well their sad history and how they were pushed north and then west, away from their traditional homeland. How they must have longed for the waters of the four lakes of their birthplace and the dry, lakeless regions of their reservations. If she walked the path to the end of Picnic Point, she could find evidence of the earlier and more enigmatic effigy mound builders that had claimed the ridgetops facing the lake as their sacred burial places. There were other large earth monuments that astonished her when she came upon them unexpectedly amidst the modern campus buildings. These protected mounds rose up in archaic shapes, mute testimony to a mysterious past. The lake itself was the signature of that even more distant master sculptor who worked in ice and had cast a call of frozen water many hundreds of feet thick across this part of the earth. Ice, that was her father's domain, both intellectually and emotionally. Geology
had drawn him to this campus where he had built his career. Primordial glaciers were his specialty. The subject suited him. Remote and cold. Van rubbed her upper arms, shook her head to clear it, and checked her watch. Now she was too late for her office hours. Her briefcase bulged with final exams. Back in the parking garage, she picked the Iowa map from the paper bag and shoved the rest in the trunk as if she were hiding a criminal act. She walked down the hill from Bascom Hall to the student union. The long trudge up the hill in winter boots, heavy coat, scarf, and mittens, punctuated by white puffs of frozen air, was easy to forget in the lush blossoming of early June. She ordered a large draft beer at the student union and walked onto the terrace where a skirt of paving stones and grass fronted Lake Mendota. These were the reasons she loved this campus. The bright orange, yellow, and green metal tables and chairs spread across the terrace like a flower garden. And you could buy beer in the union, even though it was only 3.2 beer and tasted thin and pissy. She found an empty table and took a long swallow of cold beer. Talk to Vanjie. The note bugged her. That sure as hell would have been some conversation. She opened the highlighted map. Were you actually expecting me to take a trip to Iowa with you? She muttered. The thought of the two of them held captive for hours on a car trip was unthinkable. Yet there it was. Ask Vanjie to do some research. His last wish, written in his hand. Would it plague her for the rest of her life if she refused to honor it? Her teaching career was her whole life. Although Van had cracked open a few doors in women's studies, she kept bumping into the walls of academe. She had hopes that a sabbatical would give her room to consider her next possibilities. Iowa had not been in her plan. Despite feeling like an orphan, her father's death left her oddly untethered. No parents, no siblings. No partner, no children, no existing family ties. Mother had been an only child, and Van never knew any of her grandparents. She had learned to never ask for what she couldn't have, and later learned to shut off wanting altogether. The people in the Reinhardt family portrait stirred an old longing. Maybe some of their descendants were still living in Iowa. Some folks who would be happy to claim her as their own long-lost relative? Van pictured family reunions, picnic suppers, stories, cousins, and people who looked like her. Maybe there was still a chance for kinship. Outside of his cryptic notes, she wasn't sure what her father expected. But maybe there was something in it for her. She looked at the map. Okay, I'll go, damn it. The couple at the next table glanced her way. She was talking out loud to an empty chair. Back in her apartment, Van inspected her knee and iced it. Nothing too serious, just a raw patch. She washed yesterday's dishes, fed Mister, and called Emma at her office. Dr. Cooper here. I know this is short notice, Em, but can you cat-sit Mister for a few days?
Sure, Van. What's up?
It's a long story. I'll fill you in later. I'm going out to Iowa to settle a few things for my dad.
No problem. Where's the key?
I put it back where we used to keep it. Under the big rock near the front door.
Okay. It'll be great to see Mister again.
There was a brief silence. Van could hear Emma breathing. She pictured Em in her cords and cardigan, sitting at her desk in the humanities department, surrounded by stacks of papers, a brown sparrow in her nest.
Thanks. I'll be leaving first thing in the morning. Cat food is in the usual spot in the cupboard. I'll give you a call once I am out there. I should be back in a few days.
Van hung up and looked at Mister. Em's coming over while I'm gone. The tabby circled her legs and purred. Even though they had broken up, Van could still count on Emma. The next morning, Van put her thick hair into a braid that hung halfway down her back and pulled on a pair of worn jeans and sneakers. She loaded the Honda with her tent and sleeping bag retrieved from the back of her closet where she had shoved them years ago after her last camping trip. A small backpack held toiletries and a change of clothes. Just enough getaway gear for a few days,
A cooler filled with bottles of spring water and lemons and a bag of trail mix went into the trunk. She moved the paper bag with the map and file folders to the car's passenger side and started up the car, then put it in park and went back into the apartment.
"Sorry, mister, I'm just back for a second. Em will be coming later."
She pulled a blank journal from the assortment she kept on the bottom shelf of her bookcase. As a historian, she coveted every woman's diary she could lay her hands on. Women's experience was seldom recorded, their words seldom heard, the intimate details of their lives left blank. Even when buried in stiff, stoic religious language, she searched for clues to their hidden stories. She probed the edges of their silences. In bookstores, she bought herself beautiful journals with bright blank pages, but never found time to write in them, simply added them to her growing collection. These days, Van figured, the details of her life were just too boring, and recording her inner thoughts felt creepy. Someone might find it, or, more truthfully, she wouldn't be an honest reporter, and then what was the point? On the other hand, maybe keeping a diary of this trip would give her a chance to begin. She could use the journal to record her findings, fill in the gaping holes in her father's history. Wasn't that what he wanted? She picked out an unlined journal with a faux brown leather cover and stuffed it into the paper bag.
"Okay, Dad, you want research? You want to talk? Great. Looks like it's going to be a one-way conversation."
The car had a full tank. She checked the map. The highlighted route was a straight shot from Madison to Dubuque on Highway 18. How typical.
"Sorry, Dad, I'm the one driving, so we're going to take this scenic route."
The radio was tuned to WIBA. Bon Jovi came on with "It's My Life." She turned the volume up and sang along in a rush of energy. "It's my life. It's now or never. I ain't gonna live forever. My heart is like an open highway." Van drove west on Highway 14 to Mazomanie and then headed for Spring Green and the Wisconsin River. She was always drawn toward water. Lakes, ponds, river water. Only fresh water, never salt. The Wisconsin River had once been used as a highway for the French trappers who paddled down the waterway from the Great Lakes centuries before. Her research had uncovered old illustrations of their big freighter canoes, piled high with shiny fur skins, the native people in canoes with blanket sails, the French-speaking voyageurs with their red-tasseled toques bringing in the season's load of skins. The Wisconsin River was a throbbing artery, a yearning, shifting flowage with sandbar islands and channels that carved a landscape of hills, bluffs, and valleys until it joined the Mississippi. If lakes were moody and tempestuous, rivers were ardent, inventive, and full of longing. A flash of brown shot out from a field of high grass on her right. She slammed on the brakes and swerved toward the ditch as the deer made high arcing leaps across the road and disappeared into a group of oak trees. She gripped the steering wheel, her heart banging high in her throat. Why do deer choose that exact moment when they are most likely to get killed? Luckily, she had not collided with the animal or crashed into the ditch. She pulled onto the side of the road and put the flashers on. Her jaw was clenched, and her breath took time to reclaim its normal rhythm. She felt scared. What had she been thinking? Van purposely hadn't been back in the area for more than 30 years. Now she remembered why. The pastoral beauty of the Wyoming Valley was haunted on too many levels. Down the road was Frank Lloyd Wright's restored home and architectural studio. Taliesin never ceased to draw visitors who were captivated by its artistic splendor and horrific history. In 1914, the original living quarters had been set on fire by a deranged servant, but not before he axe-murdered Wright's mistress, her children, and a number of other workers. Wright rebuilt, only to have the next building burn due to bad wiring. Again, Wright stubbornly built against fate, and now Taliesin stood as a monument to his willful genius, a survivor of its traumatic past. Wisconsin Gothic. Was it admirable or arrogant for Wright to persevere in the face of such bloody madness?
Wasn't he haunted by guilt?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?